VOA News. I'm Laurel Bowman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Kyiv, Ukraine, says that American military aid on its way to Ukraine will make a real difference in its war with Russia. VOA's Tommy McNeil reports.
Blinken's remarks came Tuesday as the top diplomat made an unannounced visit to reassure an ally facing a fierce new Russian offensive. According to open source monitoring analysts, Moscow's troops have captured around 100 to 125 square kilometers of territory that includes at least seven villages in recent days. Though most of those villages were already depopulated, thousands of civilians in the area have fled the fighting. Analysts have called this moment one of the most dangerous for Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion. President Volodymyr Zelensky asked for more air defense systems to protect civilians in the northeast. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma now reports on the social upheaval in Gaza as war continues to rage between Israel and Hamas there.
The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees says 450,000 Palestinians have been driven out of Rafah in Gaza South over the past week. There were roughly 1.3 million people sheltering in Rafah before Israel began pushing into the city, which Israel says is the last Hamas stronghold. Israeli forces are also battling Hamas militants in northern Gaza. The army's evacuation orders issued on Saturday have displaced around 100 people so far. UN Deputy Spokesman Farhan Haq told reporters on Monday. Palestinian officials say Israeli strikes in central Gaza have killed at least 12 people overnight and into Tuesday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And Donald Trump is back in court for his criminal trial today. This is VOA News. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi defended himself against criticism that he is stoking divisions between Hindus and Muslims to win national elections, as he filed his nomination on Tuesday for re-election. India began voting April 19th in the seven-phase election in which Modi is seeking a third straight term. At least two French prison guards were shot dead and three others seriously injured Tuesday after heavily armed men ambushed a prison van to free an inmate, French police said, triggering a major manhunt. The orchestrated attack in northern France comes amid rising drug-linked violence across Europe. The inmate and the attackers escaped, according to police. Kazakhstan's former economy minister has been sentenced to 24 years in prison for murdering his wife. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino has more.
The widely watched trial, broadcast live over 7 weeks, was seen by some as a litmus test for the president's promise to strengthen women's rights. 44-year-old Kwandyk Bishimbaev was found guilty of torture and murder by the court. CCTV footage captured Bishimbaev arguing with his 31-year-old wife, Saltanat Nukanova, on the night she died. During the trial, separate footage showed Bishimbaev punching and kicking Nukanova before dragging her by her hair into a room, where she later died. The trial has been widely regarded as an attempt by authorities to send a message that members of the elite are no longer above the law.
That was Reuters' Olivia Zolino reporting. And there's a shakeup underway in the probation department in the U.S. city of Los Angeles, California. The AP's Donna Warder reports.
The Los Angeles County Probation Department says that over the past 5 months, it's put 66 of its officers on administrative leave for suspected offenses such as sexual abuse, excessive force, and drug possession. The department made the announcement Monday, saying it wants to regain public trust as it roots out employees engaged in misconduct. The probation officers were assigned to both the department's adult and juvenile operations. Officials say that of the 66 officers, 39 were cited for general misconduct, which includes suspected use of excessive force, child endangerment or abuse, possession of contraband, and negligent supervision. 18 were put on leave for suspected sexual misconduct. I'm Donna Warder.
And Sony warns of falling profits this year as PlayStation 5 unit sales decline while staying mum on a reported bid for Paramount. I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
You can imagine fleeing from violence to save your life and then having to escape to higher ground with whatever you can carry as a storm or a flood threatens to wash away your temporary shelter.
That was Vicente Anzalini, lead author of a new study on the world's internally displaced people. Details coming up. Also, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is gravely concerned by fighting in the key Darfur town of El Fashar. And the European Union has raised concerns about post-election violence in Chad. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reports conflicts and violence have pushed the number of internally displaced people, IDPs, to a record-breaking high of 75.9 million people, with nearly half of all IDPs living in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report finds conflicts in Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Gaza accounted for nearly two-thirds of new displacement movements in 66 countries in 2023. The lead author of the newest report, Vicente Anzalini, says the number of internal displacements, that is, the number of times people have been forced to move because of conflict, has increased in the past few years. And this added to the total number of IDPs at the end of 2023. He says the new internal displacements in 2023 were mostly the result of the conflict in Ukraine, which started in 2022, along with violence in the DRC and the eruption of war in Sudan. That conflict resulted in 6 million newly displaced Sudanese people, adding to the millions there who had previously been forced from their homes.
As you know, it's more than a year that this new wave of conflict erupted. And as of the end of last year, the figure was 9.1 million. And just to flag that, this figure is the highest that we have ever reported for any country. These 9.1 million internally displaced people.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, a part of the Norwegian Refugee Council, produces an annual survey of displacements. The report covers the number of new displacements in 2023, the number of repeated displacements when a person must flee more than once in the year, and the number of people who had previously been displaced and remained unable to go home. The report says hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza were uprooted from their homes multiple times, leading to 3.4 million displacements in the last 3 months of 2023. This is 17% of total conflict displacements worldwide during the year. Sudan tops last year's list of countries with the largest number of conflict-displaced IDPs, followed by Syria, the DRC, Colombia, and Yemen. Additionally, in 2023, the report says 7.7 million people were internally displaced by natural disasters, including floods, storms, earthquakes, and wildfires. Anzalini says many countries that have experienced conflict displacement also have experienced disaster displacement.
In many situations, they are overlapping. This is the case in Sudan, in South Sudan, but also in Somalia, in the DRC. So you can imagine fleeing from violence to save your life and then having to escape to higher ground with whatever you can carry as a storm or a flood threatens to wash away your temporary shelter.
He adds this sad reality is observed in many countries across the globe. As in previous years, the report notes floods and storms caused the most disaster displacement, including in southeastern Africa, where Cyclone Freddy triggered 1.4 million movements across six countries and territories. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
According to the French news agency AFP, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is gravely concerned by fighting in recent days between the Sudanese army and rival paramilitaries in the key Darfur town of El Fashar. The international community has warned of a looming offensive on Al-Fashar, the last major city in Darfur that is not under control of the paramilitary rapid support forces. Farhan Haq, spokesman for the Secretary General, said Guterres is alarmed by reports of the use of heavy weaponry in densely populated areas, resulting in dozens of civilian casualties, significant displacement, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure. The UN chief is particularly concerned for civilians in the area who are already facing a looming famine and the consequences of over a year of war, Haq said. He repeated Guterres' call for an immediate ceasefire and for all parties to allow civilians to move to safer areas and facilitate unimpeded humanitarian access. Cameroon's military has moved over 300 civilians rescued from Boko Haram terrorist captivity along the Central African state's border with Nigeria and Chad this week to a northern Cameroon military post. The country's army says scores of militants of the Nigeria-based insurgent group were neutralized in a border operation called Alpha. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Well, 37-year-old Umar Fatimi tells Cameroon military and senior government officials that she was a successful vegetable farmer in Gubwa village until April 17, when heavily armed Boko Haram fighters abducted her and three of her family members. Gubwa is a village in Chad, located near the northeastern shore of Lake Chad, a water body shared by Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Fatimi said the abductors took her and several dozen civilians to a bush area near Lake Chad and threatened to kill them if their families failed to pay ransom. Fatimi is one of over 300 civilians Cameroon's military says were rescued from Boko Haram captivity in several villages along the Central African state's border with Chad and Nigeria within the past 7 days. The Cameroon military said most of the freed hostages are women and children. About 200 government troops carried out the rescue operation. Mijiyawa Bakari is the governor of Cameroon's far north region that shares a border with Chad and Nigeria.
La récolte a été fructueuse.
Bakari says Cameroon President Paul Biya dispatched him to Dabanga Monday to congratulate the troops that carried out the very successful rescue operation called Alpha. He says government troops seized several hundred weapons, including rifles and explosives, along with motorcycles and bicycles militants were using to attack communities and kidnap civilians for ransom. Cameroon's military says it was assisted in assaults on some Boko Haram strongholds in border localities by government troops from Chad and Nigeria. Scores of militants were killed and several dozen wounded in the operation that lasted 1 week, according to Cameroon officials. Cameroon says militants who surrendered are helping troops in investigations, but gave no further details. VOA could not independently verify if Cameroon carried out joint border military operations with troops from Nigeria and Chad. Cameroon says it is in negotiations with its neighbors to allow the rescued civilians, who are Chadians and Nigerians, to return to their communities voluntarily. Cameroon military says while waiting, the freed hostages will be taken to the Center for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration, or DDR, in Mary, a northern town near the border with Chad and Nigeria, but did not say when. The three countries say Boko Haram is recruiting new militants and attacking villages for supplies. At least 36,000 people have been killed and 3 million have fled their homes since 2009, when fighting between Nigerian government troops and Boko Haram militants spread to Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The European Union raised concerns yesterday about post-election violence in Chad, 4 days after the presidential election victory of junta leader General Mahamat Idriss Déby Itno. The French news agency AFP says that after the results were announced on Thursday, soldiers fired shots in the air in the capital N'Djamena, both in celebration and to deter protesters. The Chadian media reported some deaths and numerous injuries from these joy shots. The government refused to give the number and forbade hospitals to do so, citing respect for medical confidentiality. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Egypt says it will formally support South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice against Israel for alleged genocide in Gaza. Ambassador Ayman Zayeldin, former director of the media department at Egypt's foreign ministry, discussed the move with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Egypt has been engaged in numerous court proceedings on the international level, particularly in the International Criminal Court, of which it's a founding member, over the years and since October 7, war broke out. So this might not be the first thing. Egypt took a very active part in another procedure relating to an opinion request by the General Assembly of the United Nations. But in this particular case, I would guess that there are two factors. One relating to the merits of the court proceedings themselves, as Egypt has decided that Israel has passed one important red line after the other in terms of how far the destruction and the killing in Gaza can go. So by attacking Rafah in the way Israel started last week, Egypt found that it cannot stand by idly. The second red line which Israel has crossed is on the diplomatic level. Egypt always restrains itself from going as far as it might wish all the time when it comes to Israel to keep sufficient channels moving in terms of the diplomatic exercise. In this particular case, trying to reach a deal on the ceasefire and the exchange of prisoners. But what Israel did by walking back on its negotiating commitments and almost lending the process useless, Egypt found that Israel crossed another red line. And I think those two factors were critical in the decision to go ahead and join the court case.
On Friday, South Africa asked the ICJ to order Israel to withdraw from Rafah as part of additional emergency measures in response to the ongoing case over the Gaza war. The Egyptian move to support South Africa's case at The Hague, in which Israel has been accused of breaching its obligations under the UN Genocide Convention, was described by Israeli media as a major diplomatic blow for Tel Aviv on the world stage. Israeli media said that Washington and Jerusalem believe that Egypt is applying pressure on Israel to withdraw its forces from Rafah. Would that perceived pressure produce an Israeli response, or is it just a symbolic move?
Joining the case will not have an immediate impact because this type of case takes years for the court to issue a ruling. So in a narrowly defined pragmatic sense of the word results, we can't expect something before 3 or 4 years. But on the symbolic level, there is a lot that can be said. And I think symbolism in such cases have far more impact than the word symbolism might connotate. I see that this move by Egypt, as well as President Biden's decision to stop exporting certain weapons to Israel, have a very significant symbolic meaning that sends a very strong signal to Israel, to the Israeli public, to Israeli politicians, that now Israel is losing the main pillars of its strategic balance, the peace with Egypt and the alliance with the United States. If those two important factors are now being threatened, this is a very strong message to the Israeli.
So how would this position impact the role of Egypt in the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire deal to release hostages and Palestinians? Palestinian prisoners.
I think Egypt's role is something that it offers the parties to help them climb down from whatever trees they find themselves stuck up. So it's a help Egypt is willing to provide. But the parties are the ones who need Egypt's role, and not the other way around. So if Israel wants to find a way out of the current mess, there are few international actors that can give Israel the way out that Egypt can do. So I would expect Israel to keep its channels with Egypt going on that matter. And frankly, Egypt's role does not depend on the Rafah crossing. It depends on what Egypt can deliver diplomatically with the Palestinians, with Israel and internationally, and that's where its role comes from.
That was Ayman Zayaldeen, former director of the media department at Egypt's foreign ministry, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Zambia's external debt is $18.3 billion, with $13.4 billion restructured. It agreed to restructure $3 billion in international bonds with private commercial bondholders, Western asset managers, and hedge funds earlier this year. The country is currently negotiating with its other commercial and official bilateral creditors, which struck a deal last year. VOA's Pauline Diho recently spoke to Kenneth Mwenda, an extraordinary professor of law at the University of the Western Cape in South Africa, to provide more perspective on this issue.
For a long time, Zambia has basically been a monocultural economy dependent heavily on copper. We've struggled, we've tried to diversify into, there's a bit of agriculture, of course, but we could have done better. The approach to privatize the mines was not well handled, starting with the MMD government. This is not about UPND, it's not about PF. From the MMD government. I think there was a hurried approach towards privatization. Yes, we had to privatize a number of those state-owned enterprises because they were loss-making and it was pretty expensive and costly to keep subsidizing them. But I think there was a bit of naivety in the way we handled the thing. There was just excitement that we are privatizing. Mm-hmm. In the Western world, they don't privatize everything. I mean, right. You and I use metro, you and I use public transport owned by the government.
Right.
You don't have to sell everything. There are certain critical industries which provide social services to the country, you have to keep those. But there was a bit of naivety, I'm sorry to say, I'm just being frank, in terms of the way the MMD approach this. They sold basically everything, leaving just a few companies, a handful. We had a lot of industries which were supporting the mining sector, for example, and clothing industry, textile, cereals, and whatnot. All those are gone.
What about the issue of restructuring the debt? I know the president has been in talks with the IMF, trying to get the thing, done. But there are a lot of challenges, like you pointed out earlier. That has also complicated things. Is any of that close to the truth, or something else has to be done?
You're simply restructuring debt. You might deal with maybe interest payment or period of payment and so forth. There are various ways and techniques you can use for debt restructuring. So that must be made very clear before people begin to celebrate. The debt is still there, okay? You've just restructured it in terms of giving yourself a bit of room and leverage to reallocate some of your resources, national resources, from the budget to address other issues whilst servicing the debt. So that's very important.
When President Hakainde Hichilema came in, he promised to revive the economy, he promised to create employment, he promised so many things that from his point of view were lacking at the time. He's been in power for a while now. Has anything changed on the ground?
Good question, Paul. When you're in the opposition party, it's very easy to pick up mistakes of your friends or in government. Most people in the opposition party sound very sensible and intelligent when they're talking. But when you're put in the driver's seat, it's a different ballgame. You then realize there are certain challenges that you cannot simply deal with overnight, as you expected when you're in opposition. So I think that is really what is happening. Yes, there were promises that were made. Now the issue is, PF messed up a lot. That's why we have these problems. But you should have foreseen, that PF had messed up. So why did you make all those promises? Okay, so again, politicians need to be mindful that do not promise things that you cannot deliver. Be realistic in your campaigns. Because people will hold you the promises that you made.
Kenneth Mwenda, an extraordinary professor of law at the University of the Western Cape in South Africa, he spoke with VOA's Pauline Diho. As Russia pushed into northern Ukraine this week, the U.S. presidential race between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump remained focused on another foreign policy crisis, the war in Gaza. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, keeping American attention on Ukraine could be difficult.
The northern Ukrainian border town of Volchansk. Evacuating just hours ahead of when Russia claimed it captured the town. Ukraine fighting back with the more than $50 billion assistance from the United States approved last month by President Joe Biden. He argued for months that aid to Ukraine is a centerpiece of U.S. national security policy.
The United States walks away, it will put Ukraine at risk. Europe is at risk. The free world will be at risk, emboldening others to do what they wish to do us harm. My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away.
But analysts say presidential elections rarely turn on foreign policy issues. James Thurber is a professor at American University.
The issue of Ukraine barely registers in the polls, and the issue of foreign policy, less than 5% of the people think that's an important issue, foreign policy generally, meaning the relationship that we have with China, Communist Party of China, but also pushing back on Putin and what's happening in Gaza.
Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has argued the U.S. already sends too much aid. Earlier this year, the former president suggested he would not adhere to the Mutual Self-Defense Pact if Russia invaded a NATO country.
I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want.
That message resonates with voters concerned about American involvement overseas. Dr. Barbara Perry of the Miller Center at the University of Virginia.
The 20 years of the war on terror and the so-called endless wars probably converted more Americans to isolationism and America first. And that's why Donald Trump was successful in 2016 and why he is successful at having garnered all but officially the nomination of the Republican Party for 2024.
The push against funding Ukraine's defense against Russia put some Republicans in a difficult position this election year. But after months of delay, House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Trump supporter, brought the aid up for a successful vote.
I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys.
With protests against the war in Gaza taking place on college campuses across the U.S., analysts say there is a bigger election season discussion about how U.S. aid is spent abroad.
I do know a number of young voters in this country who think carefully about their student loan debts, as an example. Why are we spending these billions and billions of dollars sending armaments abroad to Ukraine and sending armaments to Israel? Why aren't we using those monies domestically for other issues that need caring for in this country?
The aid to Ukraine approved by Congress in April is likely to be the last disbursement this year before the November presidential election. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Gunmen who abducted 105 people in northwest Nigeria last week are not seeking ransoms. Instead, Reuters reports they are demanding negotiations with the Zamfara state government. The gunmen attacked the village of Gora, Madomawa, and Jambuzu in Zamfara's Birnin Magiji local government area on Friday night, seizing dozens of residents. Bello Muhammad, whose wife, three children, and young brother were among those taken, said he received a call Saturday night from people who claimed responsibility for the attack. Four other families received similar calls asking for the families to deliver the message to the state governor. Reuters could not reach Zamfara's information commissioner, Manir Kaura, for comment. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.